Listening to A New World Order, episode 336, for day 19 of 2020. Hey everybody, this is Glassy, your friendly host. For today's episode is all about listener feedback. I've got lots of listener feedback that's kind of been piling up a little bit. One came in before the holidays, and I'd already recorded a bunch of episodes in advance, so I didn't get around to it. And some others, I said I would respond, or I would cover it on the show, and then I put it off. So it's a little bit of a backlog, so we're going to get right in. We're just going to start right away with Mark. Mark emailed me ages ago now, almost a month ago. So usually it doesn't take me quite that long to get back to people on the show. And I do apologize, Mark. But he wanted to send in his Linux origin story because, frankly, everyone, I think everyone loves hearing about that. I love hearing origin stories for, well, a lot of things, I think. I think a lot of people actually like to hear origin stories because, I mean, think about it. You go to a school, a university, and you think, and one of the easiest questions to ask is, what made you choose this school? You know, that's an easy thing. What brings you here? That sort of question. It's a very sort of common thing. So I think hearing about how people got started with a thing that you have in common is fun. And so I appreciate Mark sending in his origin story, and here's his origin story, somewhat abbreviated for time. I wanted to talk a little bit about my origin story in computers and Linux. It began about the mid-80s with an Apple II, and remember briefly programming on that, and I was in junior high. And I didn't have another experience with computers until 1992. Someone introduced me to Netscape, which was how I got to see what the internet was like. Fast forward to around 2000, I was in school for a couple of years, and after that I got my first computer, and it was running Windows Millennium. Now that's commonly, this is Klaatu again, that's commonly known as Windows Me, and it is sort of one of those really sort of very forgotten editions of Windows. I remember at the time hearing a lot about it and how it was horrible and no one wanted to run it. And I guess, was that when XP came out, or did XP come out after ME? I don't remember. But either way, people didn't really care for Windows ME. I don't know why not. I don't know. I honestly don't understand how people judge one Windows from another. I don't know what a good Windows is like versus a bad Windows, because I'm not familiar with either of them. But I do remember hearing about Millennium, and people did not tend to like it. He says, it was kind of slow and it didn't quite suit my needs, so I built a computer with an Athlon, probably a 2 gigahertz processor, and ran XP on it. A couple of years later, somebody introduced me to Mandrake Linux. I was kind of curious, so I put it on my computer. He gave me a bunch of paperwork for a manual, and he worked his way through, Mark says, I worked my way through learning KDE and Mandrake and came across Ubuntu, probably around 7.02. I ran that for a couple of years. Then there was a point where he started to really like it a lot, not Ubuntu necessarily, but Linux in general. And what sold him on that was when he was able to import video, which he couldn't do on a Windows machine, which he was dual booting at the time, and that kind of got him hooked. After that, I tried Fedora back when it was originally Fedora Core 3 or 4, hard to remember for that far back, but I delved into that for a little bit. And then DistroOps for a little bit. There was a place I used to get disks because it took so long to download the things that it was easier to just buy it online. A year or so after that, I discovered Arch Linux, and I was using that for maybe 6 years. Then a couple of years ago, I was noticing that Klaatu, that's me, the narrator, talked a lot about Slackware. I had a lot of time on my hands because I was out of work at the time. Ended up putting Slackware on my laptop. It was a bit of an older laptop, but it installed easily. And he had some experience with it. And then sometime this year, that's 2019 at the time of his email, Claudio M, that's Claudio. You may know, dear listener, Claudio M from Linux Basement was kind of the thing that he was participating in sort of verbally for a long time. Others might know him from Hack Republic Radio. He's a great guy, really, really smart, and musician and a computer guy. So this is Mark again. Sometimes this year, Claudio M introduced me to FreeBSD. I'd seen him talking on Mastodon about it, and I conversed back and forth with him. It sounded like something interesting, so put on a flash drive and installed it on an old tower. And in between all that, I have experimented with different distros on Raspberry Pis. I've tried Debian and was running Arch on a server for a little bit, and then I was trying BSD, and that seemed pretty nice, so I'm keeping that on the Pi for the time being. That's his little origin story. I think it's really interesting. I will make a couple of comments about some things, try not to go over too much that I've already sort of said before. I first of all think it's really interesting that Mandrake was his intro. I really honestly don't quite understand Mandrake's fall from grace. I honestly don't, and I kind of regret it. I'm kind of sad about it to this day. Not that I was ever a paying member of Mandrake, because at the time, at that time, at 2002, I was not able to pay for Linux. That was one of the big appeals at the time. I couldn't pay for anything, so I could barely pay rent. So the free, $0 free aspect of Linux was truly an appealing thing to me back when I was getting into Linux. Now, 2002 predates me anyway, so that wouldn't have been it. But I did get in time for Mandriva to be, you know, they were releasing things, and they had the Mandriva, the thing that you could join, a club, I think. It was just a club, I think is what it was called. And that seemed really appealing to me, and I liked the idea, and I thought, well, that's a great thing to fall back on, and as you do, you just kind of think it'll always be around. And now that I'm gainfully employed and all that other nonsense, it's gone. It's not around anymore. And in fact, the model of paid support for anything computing, I feel, is kind of gone. And I think that's a little bit of a pity. I think that the separation of support and the operating system, I think, is not a great thing. Across the board, and I don't mean just within Linux, I mean across the board. The fact that you can't, that there's no sort of accountability for anything on a computer these days, I don't feel comfortable with that. If there's an exchange of money, like if there's no exchange of money, then okay, well, you get what you get, and that's kind of the implicit, that's the thing. But, and I guess that's how most of the internet works, really. And if you get angry, you just go on, and I do say this significantly, you go on Twitter and you yell at the company and you hope to sort of shame them into responding to you by making noise publicly. And it's really, I think, encouraging this culture of demanding some kind of justice for yourself. And it's not really, you know, there's no guarantee that the exception being made for you publicly to silence you on Twitter is going to extend to anyone else. It's purely for you. It's sort of an advertising campaign for the company that you're yelling at. So the fact that there's just no culture around, okay, well, if you want guaranteed something, then give us money, and then we'll be accountable to what we just sold you. That just doesn't exist. And that's one thing for open source $0 software, but if there's a contract for closed source software, I definitely think that there should be some kind of guarantee for payment. And I always did kind of like that there was sort of a fallback on in Linux when people would say, oh, there's no support for Linux. Well, there is support for Linux. Here are the contracts. Now, it was always funny when I would point them to either Mandriva or Ubuntu at the time, or Red Hat. People would think, would still, you know, it's any time someone complains about Linux not having something, and then you turn around and you say, actually, it's right here, and then they never, you know, it's like you call the bluff, and then the conversation's sort of over, because it's like, well, they also don't have Photoshop. You know, oh, well, naturally, that's the one I can't get around, right? I mean, that's the easy one. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's always sort of something out of reach, and that's fine, but why engage in conversation when you know that anything, you know, that you might as well just shut the conversation down and just say, look, I'm not going to use Linux. Don't say you're not going to use Linux because of some fake reason. Just say you're not going to use Linux because you don't want to. It's fine. Anyway, way off track there. So that was Mandriva. I miss it a little bit. Mandrake, whatever. And then, yeah, his foray into FreeBSD. FreeBSD I don't mess with FreeBSD anymore. As you may remember, I did try FreeBSD on a Pi, and it didn't journal its file system by default, and so I swore it off. Very, very willfully decided I would never try it again. That's probably not in any way true. I did, but I guess it isn't true because I tried. Well, I guess it is true. I haven't tried FreeBSD lately, but I did try TrueOS. No, it was called Trident or Trinity. No, Trident. Project Trident, and it's interesting. It's not quite PC PC BSD. That was it. It's kind of what it supplanted. And I have to admit, I kind of miss PC BSD a little bit. But NetBSD is doing quite well for me on a Pi. That said, I need to set that back up now that I have moved again. Anyway, BSDs are fun to play with, and if you enjoy Slackware, which you may if you're listening to this show, you may not, but I mean if you do, then the BSDs are kind of I would say within a similar space. So there's that. There's Mark's email responded to as promised. Just really, really late. I do apologize about that. Okay, so I got a message from Carl. Carl, you may know, dear listener, probably not as well as me for this thing that I'm about to mention, but he sent me coffee, and man, have I been enjoying it. And I did talk about it at one point, so you may remember that name. Anyway, as a little aside to a relatively unrelated email, he mentions a link, which I will have to include in the show notes. And the link is to undeadly.org, which is OpenBSD stuff. And this particular blog post that he links to is about the MDoc, or rather the Mandoc tool, which converts the markup language MDoc to other languages, so or to other formats rather. And so this is really tangentially about that. It's that he was improving this tool to include Markdown as a target, and in so doing, he discovered how much he hates Markdown. And this is a subject probably closer to my heart than it really ought to be. I mean, it's not that big of a deal, but it just comes up a lot in the stuff that I do. And so it's kind of an interesting, it's a really fascinating sort of problem, I guess, and that is the fact that Markdown's not very good. This author, PITRH is his username, and he has a lot of really great points, and I'm going to try to go through them real quickly without too much commentary. So first of all, lack of expressiveness. He says Markdown's weak and powerless even by its own standard, which is make formatting easy for anything to be expressed in plain text. For example, it doesn't provide any syntax for definition lists, or definition lists. So that would be the DL in HTML, or the .BL in MDoc, or .TP in MAN. I don't think that's as big of a deal as he probably says. I think where a definition list is required, you can usually fake with like maybe bold, or like a fake heading, and then some bullet points under the heading or something like that. So for me, it's not a big deal, but it's a good point. Context sensitivity. The syntax and semantics are extremely context sensitive. Almost every token can be take completely taken has a completely different meaning depending on where it appears, and that's very true. I don't know that that's a weakness though, but it is. I mean, I gather from what he is saying, by as someone who has required to parse Markdown, that it is a problem, because I can imagine, I mean, you can't just say, okay, well, search for an asterisk, because what does the asterisk do? Well, if it's left, if it's all the way to the left, then it does one thing. If it's indented a little bit, then it's something else. If it's indented more, then it's something else. If it's not indented at all and it sort of surrounds a word, then it's, you know, so it gets messy. And that's a great point that he makes right afterwards. Ambiguity. Syntax for emphasis and underscoring and bolding and so on it doesn't really quite work. And this is true too. I've seen this in action. And for instance, if you have a long variable name, long underscore var underscore name, some parsers are going to confuse that for long underlined var name. They shouldn't, because there's no space between long underscore vars underscore name, but it could happen. If you have a bold word and then an italic word and then a bold word, then a lot of times the you have so many asterisks there that they get confused as to where one starts and where one ends. So that can get tricky. And again, this is a lot of this weakness kind of appears in the parser rather than just sort of saying, well, that's a little bit unclear. And many of these are edge cases, but with edge cases, they're not an edge case to you when you are trying to get the thing to cooperate. So there's a mix-up of semantic and presentational markup. You can't switch off filling, which is presentational manipulation, without getting code tags, which is semantic markup. You can't get indentation, which is presentational, without either a code or a block quote, which are both semantic. There are certainly several more examples of that you could use, or that you can think of. Trust me, there are lots of those. And I don't know really the best way around that for markup, honestly. Like, you can see the intent, and it's sort of an admirable intent. It's just that if you're coming to this thing a little bit differently than the person who designed it, then suddenly that becomes useless. For instance, the definition, I haven't looked lately whether this is even in the original Markdown text or spec, or whether it's actually GitHub or some other flavor of Markdown. But the double backticks around a word or a group of words to make it monotype and sort of inline code snippet, really that's presentational, sort of, because you're doing the backticks to say, okay, well, I want you to adjust the font to be monotype when you see when a string is surrounded by two backticks or a single backtick in some spec. So that's pure presentation. I guess in a weird way, Markdown almost combines presentation and semantics in some cases, as long as you know what those semantics are, what they map to. But it's still, it is presentation primarily, because you're only putting the backticks around it because you know that when you convert it to HTML or a PDF or whatever, then you want it to be in monotype to look like a code element. So, this is the problem that he's talking about. He says lack of independence. Markdown is not a self-contained language. It allows embedding arbitrary HTML code. To this, I would say allows more like requires, because as I've said before, nobody can do Markdown without resorting to HTML at some point. And I say that with a little bit of hyperbole, but not much. Syntax inspired by white space. A line break with a paragraph without a paragraph break requires white space at the end of the preceding line, but the number of trailing blanks is semantically significant. There must be at least two. So the two line endings foo with a new line, and foo with two new lines have different meanings. And that's obviously Markdown was inspired. I say obviously, but I'm assuming Markdown was heavily influenced by Python. I don't actually know that, but whatever. Lack of standardization. Yep, that's huge. I've talked about that before. There's Common Mark in an effort to try to actually bring a reasonable spec written by people who kind of understand the requirements for a parser, and also have kind of a larger design in mind. But largely, it's unstandard. It's not standard. There's no standardization. Lack of extensibility. It wasn't designed with extensibility in mind, and it shows. I feel it's a weird one because actually there's a bunch of extensibility. He even cites it in his blog post. He says there's Python Markdown, there's PHP Markdown. I've never heard of either of those, but there's GitHub Markdown and so on. So he says there's no documentation for the GitHub Markdown. I feel like, I had a hard copy of the GitHub Markdown documentation for the longest time on my desk, so I know that someone wrote a document for it. Point being, though, I feel like if that's not extensibility, then I'm not exactly sure what would be. So I think he's just saying that because there's no single standard, it's not like people are expanding on Markdown. They're just sort of rolling their own Markdown. But here's where it gets tricky, and I'm leaving the blog post now, so this is all just Klaatu pontificating. Here's where it gets tricky. The idea of Markdown is that there is structure to text, and honestly, that alone, I feel, is good enough. And it sort of pains me to say that, because good enough never really sounds all that great, but in a way, that's good enough for me. Because as someone who finds themselves parsing text, just a bizarrely, it's something that I do a lot more than I think I should be doing. I don't know how I find text, so much text to parse, but I just eventually do. In my hobbies and in projects that I'm working on, there's always some big dump of text that I need to parse. And there are, very frequently, they are poorly formatted. Now, it's a beautiful thing if I can get the text in HTML, because with beautiful soup from Python, I can usually grab that HTML and kind of manipulate it in the way that I want it to be manipulated. And I've done that for lots of projects. I've done that with very large chunks of text where I've been able to just rearrange everything, because everything's at least been tagged somewhat predictably, usually sometimes. And unfortunately, that's the reality of HTML, is that a lot of people misuse HTML. The reality of Markdown, in my experience, is that it's used frequently and oftentimes correctly, because it is a little bit of it. It's not very forgiving. Honestly, I mean, it's more forgiving than DocBook, certainly. It may be as forgiving as HTML, but people see the results are wrong relatively quickly whenever they're publishing it or rendering it, and then they go back and correct the thing. So I've had good experience with Markdown, because people tend to, whether you know, sort of like out of respect for the spec, which I don't believe it generally is, or just the desire to make it look like what they want it to look like when they render it, they conform to the spec. And that's a heck of a lot better than unformatted text. It really, really is. I've had horrible, horrible experiences with just these big dumps of text, and every single one is different. Every file is different because one author decided to do really cool chapter headings with underlines, and the other one decided to do hashes, and the other one decided to not mark them at all, or someone else decided to do them numbered, and so on. So just providing some semblance of predictability, if that's the only goal of Markdown, which in a way I kind of feel like it is, then I'll take it. Would I prefer it to be better defined for more use cases? Yes, I would. I think that would be brilliant. I would love that. The more Markdown could be sort of a flexible language for you know, authors and for coders alike, that would be great. Yeah, I mean, I meant authors, like artistic authors, like people writing fiction, for instance, and people writing about code, and people writing manuals for processes of some sort. That would have to be technical. You know, I mean, point being, it was clearly designed by like this one person, and I don't know what this one person's sort of day job was or what he had in mind, but as far as I can tell, it was sort of like, well, here's a better way to write 90% of HTML without having to resort to tags, and the extra 10% we'll do with tags, because why not? It's just weird. And not everyone necessarily is targeting the web. So for Markdown to have such a close relationship to HTML does get a bit awkward. Now, the author acknowledges that there are alternatives. He declines to comment about them because he says he doesn't have all that much experience with them, which is nice. A lot of people wouldn't take that opportunity to not comment on stuff that they don't know about. And he does. And it's funny because two of the ones that he mentions, I've got quite a lot of experience with. Well, no, one of them I have quite a lot of experience with. The other one I have a fair amount of experience with. And those are RST or restructured text and ASCII doc. Restructured text I worked with for about 3 years straight. I worked almost exclusively in restructured text. And I have to admit, generally speaking, I preferred it to Markdown, except when it didn't do what I wanted it to do. Now, not that Markdown would have, but it just, I found it, I guess, as limiting as Markdown when you wanted to sort of get more complex, I guess, than what it wanted you to do. Same goes for ASCII doc. I mean, it's ASCII doc is kind of interesting. I didn't know this until I started working with it in real life. That, or rather at work. Work isn't real life, but it's also not podcasting. So whatever that is, work life, started working with ASCII doc a little bit, a couple of months ago. And it's interesting because it actually outputs to DocBook. So in a way, it's like Markdown is, it is to DocBook as Markdown is to HTML. And I will say that compared, you know, if you compare DocBook to HTML, by the way, undeadly.org, this blog post here specifically says that DocBook is, quote, an abomination. So that's kind of humorous because it's one of my favorite languages for writing content in, because it is so well defined and it is flexible enough for me, and it is really well defined. Did I mention that? It does exactly what, you know, it's very predictable. It's very strict, which is refreshing, because that means, you know, as long as you learn it, then things, you know how to produce things in a very specific way. And ASCII doc outputs to DocBook. And so its back-end toolchain ends up being the DocBook toolchain. But I think the problem with both restructured text and ASCII doc is that, yes, they are better defined than Markdown, but the better defined of the language, the more difficult it is to learn confidently. For instance, I couldn't sit down right now and write a document in either ASCII doc or restructured text off the top of my head. Whereas I feel like even if I wasn't working with Markdown very commonly now, I would still be able to write Markdown many, many years later, because it's just so natural feeling. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly what I'm saying, other than I feel his pain with Markdown, but I also respect Markdown for the structure, the easy and intuitive structure that it does provide, and it's just a real shame that it's not easier to parse, I guess. Okay, it's time for a coffee break. Let's do it. Let's continue with the listener feedback. I got one. I feel like I'm missing a feedback. So if I've not responded to something that I said I was going to respond to you personally, do let me know, because I really do feel like there's one gone missing. I did get a message from someone the other week about this thing called the 5 Geek Social Fallacies. And this was a blog post, I guess, from 2003, December of 2003. So it's been a while. And that's actually kind of why I want to talk about it. Because, I mean, you hear the title, 5 Geek Social Fallacies. And I mean, I'd never read this before. I'm coming to it after someone told me about it. So I have no idea sort of the background of this post. I don't know how, maybe it was a big deal back in its day. I really have no clue, but it's really, really fascinating to look back at. I mean, obviously the term geek and nerd and things like that. I'm thinking of, there's another one that I'm thinking of, but it's not coming to mind. I mean, obviously that sort of thing already, we all kind of know that that has changed. And some of us know, I think, that it's changed relatively recently. Like it's very, very fresh that term has changed. Like we're people who remember when those terms were just things that you would run from, like they would cause you real pain. And so it's just so fascinating for everyone, I think, that it's now a flowery term that you can just sort of throw around and people will welcome it. People will even announce themselves as geeks and so on. So, I mean, it's a big deal. It's fairly recent. And I think this blog post kind of demonstrates that in a weird tangential way. So the first geek social fallacy here is ostracizers are evil. So this is really, really tricky. And I can't tell you, I encourage you to go read this blog post for yourself because it really is fascinating. But it is so tricky. It hasn't, it's only 2003. So it's only been 17 years, which isn't that long. And yet it is almost it's like reading Shakespeare in its complexity, at least for me, because the terminology and your preconceptions of personality types here are not what you think they are. So, and even your, so you might think, well, geek today is a cool hip person, right? Okay, great. Okay, but then you go back to 2003 and say, okay, geek then, well, they're probably talking about this other thing. But no, actually, okay, so what they're talking about is a normal person who is a geek. And what they're saying is that ostracizers are evil. So as a normal sort of geek, just like imagine yourself, assuming you're a normal, nice sort of human being, and I'm sure you are, dear listener, as a geek, and they're saying that you would be afraid to exclude anyone from your, let's just call it your party, from from a gathering or whatever, from a party, because you don't want to be the one to exclude someone because you're a geek. And back in school, you were excluded from lots of things because you played Nintendo too much, or you knew how to program a computer, or whatever, whatever the problem was with you back in school. So that's the place this blog post is coming from. And what they're criticizing here is that in geek groups, there were too many people who would not stand up and say, okay, dude, what you're doing right now is not cool, so cut it out. And the example that they're providing is, for instance, someone's coming to an RPG or a comic book convention or a gathering, trying to get into these hobbies, but there's a bad actor around. Someone who's trying to be a gatekeeper, saying, "Oh, you can't do this because you don't know which issue of this magazine, of this comic, this supervillain first appeared in, or whatever." How people do that, and so strangely, so that's the person they're saying, no, that's the person you should ostracize, which I think that's. We could talk about that, right? We could. Ostracizing is a term that is pretty strong, actually. So I think probably in modern, maybe sensitivity, you might say, well, don't ostracize them possibly at first. Maybe take them aside and talk to them and sort of like get them to be a little bit more inviting and inclusive and so on. So, I mean, different time then, different standards, not a big deal. But do you see how I'm talking about something that's only 17 years ago? I mean, it's just weird to me that it's that big of a deal. And maybe it's not that big of a deal. Maybe people did that, like in the 90s. Maybe people were talking about, wow, back in the early 80s, it was so weird this was happening. So who knows? I don't know. But I just think it's really fascinating that there's so much complexity wrapped up in this. And I think today this whole thing would be a completely different. I think today, I don't even know that I feel today people would be saying that all geeks are like that one bad actor of 2003. I think like at least the critique I hear is that all of the people don't want new people in the club, and so they are ostracized, So the idea of saying, oh, geeks are hypersensitive and don't want to ostracize bad actors, I feel like that alone is a completely sort of disjointed history from what we have now, where where, at least again, just to critique, and I'm not saying that this is accurate or not, I'm simply saying it is a critique that I hear, that is that geeks are, almost by nature, ostracizers, which really, it's quite a shift in perception, I think. So the second fallacy is, friends accept me as I am. And it says, after being victimized by social exclusion, again, it's assuming that these geeks that they're talking about were the people in school who got made fun of, which again, in today's world, I don't think that that's as much of a thing. You know, I know that's not as much of a thing. I mean, if you took a kid from a young person from now and put them, you know, back in probably the world of, I don't know, maybe the late 90s or something, or the 90s or 80s, and had them talk as much about video games as people do now, they would be promptly bullied. It would not be, there wouldn't be a question about it. That was lame, or, you know, whatever. So after being victimized by social exclusion, many geeks experience their quote-unquote tribe as a non-judgmental haven where they can take refuge from the cruel world outside. Seems reasonable. It's important for people to have space where they feel safe and accepted. Ideally, everyone's social group would be a safe haven. When people who rely too heavily upon that refuge feel insecure in that haven, however, a commendable ideal mutates into its pathological form. They believe, so in the pathological form, they're saying, these people believe that since a friend accepts them as they are, anyone who criticizes them is not their friend. Thus, they can't take criticism from friends. Criticism is experienced as a treacherous betrayal of friendship, blah, blah, blah. So that's kind of an interesting one. I feel like it is just funny because nowadays I feel like the concept of a quote-unquote safe space is somehow unpopular. I don't know why. I feel like everyone should have a safe space. Like, every place should be a safe place, right? There should not be a non-safe place out there. So it's kind of funny now, again, at least in my world, there's so much sort of resistance to this concept of, oh, we don't need a safe space. We need to be able to say whatever we want to and do whatever we want to, whatever. And it's just, it's odd to me that the concept of a safe haven, as this blog post put it back in 2003, is apparently a reprehensible concept to many people now. And yet, in 2003, they were speaking of it as, well, that's why geeks get together. Because they feel like, in the company of other geeks, they are in a safe haven, or otherwise stated as maybe a safe space. So that's interesting. Again, and again, I'm not saying that any of this is either correct or incorrect. I am simply saying that based on what I'm hearing sort of as critique of communities now, I feel like it's kind of odd that in 2003 that was sort of the default setting. That was the expectation and the interpretation of what all these geeks were doing when they got together and crowded around the computer or played some game around a tabletop or whatever. Social fallacy 3, friendship before all. That one didn't connect with me, so I'm not gonna talk about that. I've never experienced that particular social fallacy. Social fallacy 4, friendship is transitive. This is interesting. It's an interesting social commentary. I don't think it's got anything to do with geeks. I think it's more about introverts or something. And they're saying that that the friends should sort of be able to get combined. Like, so if you have a friend from, I don't know, work or something, I don't really know where people have friends, but I'm assuming you might have some at work, and then you might have some at your computer gaming club, maybe, and then you're saying, oh, let's put them all together in one place and have them party together. I don't know. I really don't know the situation where this is all happening. It's all very foreign to me. So I guess it kind of doesn't connect, but at the same time, it kind of does, because I think what they're saying here is that geeks are often introverted, and introverts don't understand how friends work, which I can't argue with. So then geek fallacy 5 is friends do everything together. And again, this one didn't really connect with me because I've never thought of that at all. Never felt that way. They say that geeks of 2003, I guess some thought that if you're friends, you have to go do everything together for all time, and maybe if someone goes to do something without you, then you feel hurt. Didn't connect with me at all. I've never experienced anything like that. I've never had a friend who experienced that, as far as I know, so it doesn't really connect. But anyway, it's an interesting blog post. You should go look at it with a sort of a historical view. It's just, yeah, it's a thought-provoking piece. Not in a, well, maybe in a big way. I mean, it certainly made me think of some big ideas. So yeah, you should go read it. I'll put it in the show notes, probably, if I remember. Okay, and then finally, the final bit of feedback isn't feedback. It's just something that I wanted to note. And the thing that I want to note is on Slackware. And there's really no reason to note this whatsoever, except that it is a little bit of a thing. It's a thing. So on January 13, there was an addition to Slackware called NVI. And the release note reads as follows, or the entry in the change log reads as follows. This is an implementation of the classic EX/VI text editor written by Keith Bostick. Due to this having UTF-8 support, which Elvis lacks, we'll have it take over the EX/VI symlinks if they aren't already pointing to a different choice. Note that the removal of VI/EX symlinks from the Elvis and Vim packages might cause your EX/VI symlinks to point to this after all the EX/VI packages have been upgraded. You can set them to your preference using package tool setup VI/EX. This is a note about VI and X, neither of which I use. I don't use VI, and I don't use EX. I don't have anything against either of them. I just happen to not use them, and I mean to the degree that I don't even have them installed. So just to be clear at how I really don't use those things. It's just kind of significant though, because in Slackware, I think ever since the very beginning, there's been Elvis. Elvis has always been in Slackware. Elvis is a text editor. It was meant as a modern replacement for EX/VI of Unix fame. I'm just reading it right out of the man page here. Elvis supports many new features, including multiple edit buffers, multiple windows, multiple user faces, including an X11 interface, and a variety of display modes. This is kind of funny. Second paragraph in its man page. To exit Elvis, you can give the command colon Q in each of its windows. I think that's funny just because, that is kind of the classic joke, right? Not that I think it's a funny joke, I just think it's interesting that they address that right in the second paragraph. But anyway, I'm getting sort of beside the point here. The point being, Elvis is historically significant to many people as a part of Slackware, and it was just kind of interesting to see Elvis either, I don't know if it's getting removed or just if it's, if it's just NVI is replacing it as sort of the primary editor. I have no allegiance to Elvis whatsoever, because as I said, I don't use VI or Vim, but it's a little bit bittersweet, I guess, to see it evaporate from Slackware. Although, again, I don't know. I haven't actually seen Elvis get removed necessarily. I mean, I haven't seen it get added either, but I haven't been looking for it. But I just know that it was Pat Volkerdien's first editor, if I remember his comment on the subject before. And to see it not get to be included in Slackware I guess it's symbolic of progress. It's kind of the way things work. And I think it's an important symbol of progress too. There are times at which sort of allegiance to a specific thing in computing becomes kind of silly, and you kind of have to give that up. And it's difficult to do that. It really is. I completely understand that. And it's even more difficult, I think, to differentiate between the things that someone just sort of came up with on a when they were bored one afternoon versus something that has been developed as a viable alternative because there have been real issues with the thing that already exists, and it just can't function the same way. So it's tough to to come up with that sort of determination to really be able to pin something down and think, yeah, okay, this is an important change and I'm going to have to accept it versus, well, that's a dumb change and I'm not going to accept that. I mean, that goes for so much in the Unix world. And as I've often said, one of my favorite things about Unix and Linux, POSIX in general, is the fact that it has that history to it, that unchanged history for 40 years or whatever it's been. It brings me, I don't know what brings me greater joy to know that this little pamphlet that I've referenced for the past three episodes on my desk from 1982 or whatever I said it was from, like, this is still a valid pamphlet. It still has a bunch of commands in there that I can use right now, today, and all the options are still valid. I mean, it's crazy. That's unheard of. I love it when I go into a used bookstore, back when I knew where those existed, and I would ask for computer books, and they would say, oh, we just have a bunch of old ones. There's probably nothing in there that you can use. And I walk out with a book about Unix that's completely still valid. I mean, that's really, really cool. So I'm a big fan of that kind of that stability. I run Slackware. Obviously, I'm a fan of stability. And it's just kind of hard to know when things have to change and when it stops being viable to keep it sort of historically pure to what it used to be. And it gets further complicated because sometimes that's a matter of personal use cases, right? I mean, it's very much like the Markdown versus, DocBook question. I mean, like, what's your use case for this thing? Why is it not working for you if it's not working? It may be because you're trying to write something that is heavily reliant upon formatting, and you're realizing that Markdown doesn't really allow for that and doesn't have a styling language natively associated with it and so on. Or it might be because you can't imagine why anyone would ever need the ability to run two separate sound applications at the same time. Like, why would anyone need to use a sound card at the same time? What's Pulse 4 again? These are real things where you might actually not, like, within your little bubble of a world, you just don't need those functions. And so it doesn't make any sense when people go in and think and then start telling you that they need the change. So, yeah, it's a funny, funny thing, all this stuff in a stable OS world. And it's great, and I think in Linux that we have the choice to reject some of the changes that we just happen to not like. It's great that we have another, a completely other sort of sister operating system, BSD, to fall back on if we say, oh, well, I just can't, I'm just not into the way that this project's going, I'll just go over here. I mean, that's a great thing. It's exciting, and it's because there is code out there that people own for themselves and can modify it and can share it. And if nothing else about technology seems to be working in this world today of rampant capitalism, of nonstop rampant warfare, high-tech warfare, and everything else that's wrong with everything, at least we have open source, which ensures that everyone can own the code that they're running on their tech. So important, and we're really lucky to be computing in a time when open source is, I guess any way you look at it, healthier than ever. Let's just keep working to keep it that way, shall we? All right, that's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. I will talk to you next week. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. my username there is @clatchu, @mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at clatchu@member.fsf.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, newworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.